tonight. Nice. Thank you all for coming out. As you know, last week we were not able to have the satsang because Davey and I were down in Los Angeles. And just very briefly, things are going wonderfully there. The energy is very positive. The numbers are slowly growing, which is good for both in Torrance and in Los Angeles. And everything is going very well. And we might as well get it over with. One of the young members of the Torrance Center has moved here, and I want to introduce her. This is Christina. Please stand up. Okay, that's the chief embarrassment that'll happen for the next period of time. Yeah, she has a nice connection with Swamiji because she's from Romania, and they spoke Romanian together. He, every time he saw her, he enjoyed speaking Romanian with her. So it was very fun. Okay, tonight's talk, our class, or satsang, or whatever it is, on renunciation. I don't want to talk very much about the form of renunciation. I want to talk about the essence of it. And I hope by the end of the evening, we will all, including myself, have a different, perhaps even opposite view of what renunciation is all about. We tend, because of both coming out of Kali Yuga and our own past training in this life and the things that we've read, especially if we've read about any of the saints, almost all of the saints that you read about were coming out of Kali Yuga or lived in Kali Yuga, and the form of renunciation during that time was different, appropriately different from what it is now. But now the renunciation has changed more into what it really is. And I'm going to read something in just a moment. But Anandamoyi Ma, we get the newsletter from Swami Mangalananda, who many of you know because he's come here and spoken. The ashram that he's in is part of the work of Anandamoyi Ma, and they send a monthly newsletter, and it's a wonderful newsletter. There's always a little nice, juicy story about somebody who met Ma and the story of it and the advice and so on. And then there's a little bit, just a half page or so, sometimes less, of sayings of Anandamoyi Ma. And I'm going to read what was sent this month. But the essence of it is, and I love this, she said that the natural food for the mind is joy. And we're always hungry until we find the ability to feast on that joy. And that's what renunciation is all about, is the ability to find the way to feast on joy. And it has almost nothing to do with don't do this and don't do that and can't have this and can't have that. That is an old form, and all it was really meant to do was to help us in our non-attachment so that we could achieve freedom. But I'm going to go ahead and read this. This is the words of Anandamoyi Ma. For devotion and faith in God, one must be single-minded through his actions. It is no use regretting that the mind is not stabilized. The mind is restless, being starved of its natural food. Feed the mind, nourish it, then it will calm down by itself. The food of the mind is perfect joy. The mind is tossing about for that joy. Though different, through different objects of the world, the mind is looking for joy, but failing to come by the object of its search, perfect joy, it is restless. This perfect joy is inherent to our nature, and the mind is aware of its taste. Isn't that beautiful? This perfect joy is inherent to our nature, and the mind is aware of its taste. For this, the partial joys of the world cannot satisfy it. I liken the mind to a child. As a child looks for the mother and is not quiet till he gets her, so is the mind seeking its mother, which is perfect joy. To me, the mind is also like a great seeker of truth. Just as a seeker cannot be contented till he gains this object and constantly strives for it, so is the mind hankering after perfect joy. Nourish it with holy thoughts, japa, kirtan, and satsang. It will be calmed through practice. Attend to your daily chores of the household. I do not call them useless, but always have an eye on God. If you keep that in view, you shall one day attain to the supreme objective. Isn't that beautiful? So, this seeking after perfect joy, she said it, Master said it, Swami says it, all the great saints say it. How many times have we heard Swamiji talk about Shankaracharya's, the Adi Shankaracharya's definition of God, Sat Chit Ananda, and Master talking about the Ananda part as being ever new, ever expanding joy. So not something static, but it's that we're seeking because it's that we came from. In the Patanjali Yoga Sutras, which Devi and I get the joy of teaching that to, generally speaking, to most of the yoga teacher training courses, and we just gave the class again, and we give an overview of Patanjali. But he starts out with the first three are very, very important and pertinent to tonight. He says, and now we come to the study of the science of yoga. And Master said that they studied with Sri Yukteswar that first sutra for 6 months. But let's say, and now for tonight, and now we come to the science of renunciation. Because what does that end now mean? Because what they studied for so long was Master, and Master kind of laughed about it. He said, you know, I expected that was the introductory sentence, the way all of us do, and then we move right on to the real stuff. But what Sri Yukteswar said is that it takes a long, long, long time before the consciousness begins to look toward God as the solution. And until that time, the person isn't interested in yoga, because yoga is the how to achieve that union with God. And you don't want to know how, I don't know, you don't want to know how to play the violin if you have no interest whatsoever in listening to violin music or classical music. I had a friend who one time called it headache music. You know, that person was not ready to go on for a deep study of the science of playing the violin. So we have to get to the point where we begin to hunger for it. Part of the way that Master explained it is that underlying this science of yoga are the two other major philosophies of India, or they don't call them philosophies, but we would in the West. One is Shankhya, and what Shankhya says basically is that the world is ever changing and ever alternating, and it alternates between pleasure and pain, light and dark. It is by its very nature made up of duality. And so if you're seeking perfect joy, you cannot find it. That's what Ananda Moy was just saying. The mind seeks it here and here and here and is ever left unnourished and hungry. And so, but until you've gone through a whole lot of Twinkies, you aren't ready for a balanced diet of fresh greens and uncooked grains or something. As Master put it, we finally get to the point where chasing after things, after happiness through things of the world, takes on an anguishing monotony. And that anguishing monotony is kind of toward the end stage of the Shankhya philosophy, which says, okay, I think they really are right when they say I'm not going to be satisfied with the things of this world. And then we're ready to move on. I won't touch on the other Vedanta because that basically describes God. So one describes what we will not be fulfilled with, and the other describes what we will be fulfilled with, and yoga describes how to get there. So Vedanta describes God, God's nature, and so on. Now, the second aphorism, the second sutra, is something that is one of the few things that all the students have to learn and know in Sanskrit. Yoga is chitta vritti nirodh. Yoga is the neutralization of the waves or the vortices, as Master translated it, of primordial feeling. And so those primordial feelings of likes and dislikes, of wanting this and wanting that, not wanting this, being abhorred by that, as long as those vortices are active, we are drawn into the world of Shankhya, of the ups and downs, of the never quite satisfying chasing after something. You know, the real problem is not the attempting to attain something in the world. The real downer comes when you actually attain it and find, as Swami said, that it always, things of the world always break their promise. So you think that fame is going to be just the most wonderful thing. Everybody will be looking at you. Everybody will be appreciating you. You get all this energy and wonderful thing. You get fame and you're a prisoner of it. You have to hide out in alleyways to avoid the paparazzi. None of us here yet have that particular problem, or maybe we don't have it in this life anymore. But we've had something like that. Otherwise, we wouldn't laugh, except as a kind of a cynical laugh, saying that guy doesn't know what he's talking about. Because down in Hollywood, there are a lot of people that think that that's going to be fulfilling. So we chase after them, and they always betray us in the end. The chasing is actually not so bad, because we have hope. It's when we achieve them that the bubble bursts and we find out that it isn't satisfying. Do we learn? Only very, very, very gradually. Well, fame as an actor didn't do it. Maybe as a musician. And thousands and thousands of variations. As Swami said to Master when he found out he'd been his disciple, probably for tens of thousands of years, he said, Master, does it always take so long? And Master said, yes. The desire for name or fame takes one away from the path again and again and again. And so gradually, 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 we begin to understand more in the real essence that achieving those things is not going to be fulfilling. It's not going to nourish us the way that we thought. And then Patanjali gives us the solution. If we neutralize those vrittis, the vrittis are little whirlpools of essentially of desire, negative or positive, but that desire is created, the patterns are created and fed by our past. And if we neutralize those, we begin to achieve freedom. In fact, if we completely neutralize them, If yoga is the neutralization of them, we automatically find union with God. And then I love the next two sutras. And he says, in that state, The seer rests in his own self. In the state of perfect joy, we're being fed by perfect joy. There's nothing we want. The vrittis are neutralized. We're at home. And then he said, if the seer is not in that state, then he is subject to the permutations of the world, of Shankhya, of the ups and downs, the pleasures and pains. So we're either in the state where the vrittis are calmed down, and then we're being nourished, as Anandamoyi Ma said, by this perfect joy which the mind remembers, the mind knows as its natural state, and is constantly hungering for, or we fall out of that state and then we're hungry again. And so renunciation is not about what we give up. Renunciation is how we feast on joy. And if we can really grasp that, then who wouldn't want to be a renunciate? Everybody wants to be a renunciate. Everybody wants perfect joy. But renunciation is not yet very attractive. In future centuries, renunciation will be extremely attractive to us. In Satya Yuga, everyone will be a renunciate. Probably they live under trees and pick fruit. It's really close to the astral plane. And so in high ages, we understand. But in these lower ages, where we're still attracted to form, we still have some residual hankering after outer things. And as long as we're hankering after those outer things as the means to fulfillment, that's why we do it. Master said so clearly, everybody in the world is motivated by exactly the same thing. We're seeking to be happy and avoid pain. That's the basic motivation. As long as we identify that with things of this world, then it's a strategy that won't work. So the great teachers come along and they basically say, the things of this world won't make you satisfied. Now, in the Kali Yuga, they go on to say, and therefore, because, as Swami put it, in Kali Yuga, the mind is kind of so narrow in its scope that it can't hold very much breadth. And it has to, if it's going to make any progress at all, it has to become really focused. And so in the Kali Yuga renunciation model, they say those things are not going to make you happy. Therefore, you cannot seek them. And so you take vows of poverty and chastity and obedience. I liked what Ken said a little earlier. Things were milling around and not quite ready. And he said, it would be a lot easier if Swami had just gone for straight obedience instead of instead of this cooperative obedience. Do it. Nice try. See, the universe is wiggly and inimical. No, don't believe that. So, if we understand deeply that it isn't the form that we're trying to give up, that's why Master said about obedience, he said, I prefer, when somebody quoted that St. Francis, who he called our patron saint, was attracted to Lady Poverty. Master said, I prefer Lady Simplicity, because poverty is not necessary to impose on ourselves. And the other vows that we take as part of the Ananda monastic order is not poverty, simplicity, not chastity, self-control, and not, I'm sorry, can obedience, but cooperative obedience. because we're trying to move the energy. Now, the only reason for taking those vows, basically, is so that we detach ourselves, kind of by rule, we detach ourselves from going after our happiness through those things. So possessions, you take the vow that you will not have possessions, you will not have money, and that's the vow of poverty and so on. So you take these vows to keep you from putting your energy out in that direction. And let's face it, there were a lot of great saints who took those vows. So they're not just silly. It's just that this is a different age, and those same saints, if they've reincarnated in this age, will take a different set of vows. Maybe some of them are sitting in this room and have taken a different set of vows. But in this age, we understand that it isn't the form that has to be given up. It's the consciousness, it's the attitudes that need to be given up. And so what we're after is non-attachment. But non-attachment in and of itself is not nearly enough, because what's left? It's like, I don't know. It's kind of the negative reverse of the coin. It's the tail side. Tail meaning, you know, from the past. We drag this tail along. But tails, the coin has a positive side, and that positive side is the yearning for, the seeking after God. And so Swami starts all of our renunciate vows with essentially the statement that the purpose of life is to seek God. Another way, in tonight's context, the purpose of life is to feast on joy. And renunciation is what allows us to have that feast. Attachment to the world allows us to think that we're going to get it, and then get empty calories all the time and constantly be hungry. And so what happens is that not only is there the need to begin to withdraw from that false goal, but we have to get attached to the positive side of it. That's why Swami says in the New Renunciate Order that it is samadhi affirming, not world rejecting. And that is a really, really important point. Samadhi affirming, not world rejecting. And so what we have to do is undertake those practices that lead us to samadhi, not undertake those practices that reject the world. And so that's what Ananda is trying to do. We're trying to explore a new form of renunciation, and not just Ananda. Swami very specifically put out the New Renunciate Order as not being about Ananda or this path or disciples of Master. It's a consciousness, and a consciousness of the world, for the world. And we have a Benedictine monk, a month or two ago, just became a Naya Swami, and we have people on different paths who have become Naya Swamis, and it's very nice. And Swami feels that this is perhaps one of the best gifts that have come to the world through him. Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about the samadhi affirming part of it. What we want to look for is joy, or we want to look for light. But I want to use the analogy of light for a moment. If you go outside here and look up, assuming that it's clear, you go outside and you look up, you'll see a lot of stars in the sky, won't you? If you go outside in the middle of Los Angeles tonight and look up, even if it's clear, you won't see many stars, because the lights that are close obscure the stars. They obscure the light coming from the stars. Now, if all you had to compare it to was the view that you could see from Los Angeles, you could very easily end up saying there are only a few stars up in the sky. What do you mean millions or billions or hundreds of billions or billions of billions? There are only a few. I could probably count them. Let's count them. You might get up to 100 and that's it. Well, if you had no frame of reference, that would be the end of it. And so the frame of reference here in terms of renunciation is that one of the things that we have to do is we have to withdraw the mind from those sense stimulations long enough for it to become more sensitive. And that's like getting away from the light. And when you get away from the light, you see more stars. And when you really get away from the light and are able to focus, you find that the universe doesn't have just a few thousand stars. I once, a year ago or so, somebody sent me something that was fascinating. It was from the Hubble telescope, and it started, it was like a zooming in, and it started with taking a postage stamp size area, if you held your thumb out, in the very darkest part of the sky, where there were no stars there. And then they took the Hubble telescope and they started looking more and more deeply, and they saw millions, not just of stars, of galaxies in that darkest part. And then in the darkest part of the darkest part, they focused on that and millions more galaxies, and just kept going that way. And so take that as an analogy for the light at the spiritual eye. If you're in the middle of Los Angeles, dedicated to a life that stimulates the senses, you can close your eyes and not see very much. But if you're going deep in meditation and you withdraw the life force from outer involvement and you go in and then you focus, you begin to go and see not just a little bit of light, but enormous light, galaxy upon galaxy upon galaxy of light. And Master described when in samadhi, the light that you see is like staring into 1,000 suns, except that, of course, it doesn't hurt. But so the sun is just a little tiny reflection of what you really see. And so the reason for meditation in one part is not some discipline, but it's to detach, and this Patanjali also talks about, it's detach the life force and the senses from the outward attachment. And if you can do that, then the stage of pratyahara, or pranayama and pratyahara, leads to true meditation. And in that true meditation, what do you find? A feast of joy. You find your own self and your own nourishment. That's what renunciation is about, is finding the feast of joy. And it has almost nothing to do about you can't do this and you can't do that, except that you have to turn the lights off if you want to see the stars. And that's what renunciation, the negative part of renunciation, is about, turning the lights off so that we can see something that's much, much more subtle. So as we begin to do that from lifetime to lifetime, then we get to a lifetime where we really are ready to look for the feast of joy. And I want to read what Swami says in the Renunciate Order for the New Age. I want to read his qualities that are there in a person who's ready to take the step of renunciation. I'm not talking here about any particular form, not pilgrim or sevaka or sadhaka or brahmachari or tyagi or nyas. All of those are just names. This is the essence. So, what then are the marks of those whom I'd consider worthy of being accepted as true renunciates. They would be those who have achieved noteworthy progress toward the attainment of the following virtues. They have no or very few attachments or desires. They are without anger. Anger appears in the heart when one's desires are thwarted. And if one has released his desires, how do they get thwarted? They accept without prejudice whatever life gives them and live by the principle, what comes of itself, let it come. They never seek to justify or defend themselves, but accept all judgments by others dispassionately, as experiences given them by God for their higher good. They keep in their hearts primarily the company of God. 6, they are indifferent to others' opinions of them. 7, they work without personal motive to please God alone. 8, they are impersonal in the sense of wanting nothing for themselves, but never in the sense of indifference to the needs of others. 9, they see all beings as striving toward the attainment of Satchitananda, ever-existing, ever-conscious, ever-new bliss, no matter how presently misguided the efforts of those, of some people may be. Thus they feel kinship with everyone and with all life. 10, they accept nothing as their own, but only as being, quote, on loan to them for the benefit of others. 11, they view pleasure and pain equally as opposites or dual expressions of the eternal divine bliss. 12, they have meditated daily for years. 13, because they are always happy in themselves, they are impervious to insults, outer suffering, failure, defeat, or disaster. They strive to live in the ideal that Paramahansa Yogananda voiced when he said, you should be able to stand unshaken amidst the crash of the breaking worlds. And 14, they strive to love God unceasingly and ever more deeply in a spirit of utter openness to be guided by his will. And so as we move in what one could be called the evolution of the soul or evolution of consciousness toward the desire for true renunciation, we begin to exhibit these qualities. And it isn't as if we have to learn them and then somehow go out and demonstrate them. They just come naturally. They're part of the nature of God, the nature of the soul. And they begin to unfold just as surely as the rose unfolds from the little bud that has hidden the rose. But we have to go through some struggle to allow them to unfold. We heard a very interesting story some years ago that there was a family and they had some chrysalises for butterflies. That they'd gotten the little caterpillars and brought them in and they wove the chrysalis and they were waiting in the spring for the butterfly to emerge. And the first one kind of chewed a little hole in the top of it and then struggled and struggled and strained and worked and finally squeezed out of that little hole and then was there kind of just exhausted, finally regained a little bit of strength, and then the wings unfolded and it became the butterfly. And then when the next one they saw was starting to chew there, they thought, well, the poor thing, we don't want it to suffer that way. And so they cut a little hole in the top so it could emerge. And that little proto-butterfly emerged and then died. And it was the struggle through that little hole that squeezed the fluids out of the wings that allowed it to survive and to become the butterfly. And so there is a struggle, a sense of struggle that is needed. as we squeeze out the tendency toward thinking that the world will give us fulfillment. And that's what, you know, we keep tossing around in talks and lectures. Oh, worldly consciousness, worldly consciousness. It isn't evil. It isn't bad. It's simply the tendency to think that the world will give you the joy that you're seeking, and it won't. And so I just want to end by kind of summing up what the very, very few real principles of true renunciation are. The first is that we see all of life as a search for God or a search for self-realization. That's the most important, because as we focus there, we become samadhi affirming rather than world renouncing. Samadhi is what allows us to achieve what we're after. The second is that we see that non-attachment is a means of releasing us into the freedom that allows us to do that. And it isn't non-attachment to things as much as it's non-attachment to attitudes. And it isn't non-attachment to attitudes as much as it is ultimately non-attachment to the ego or the desire to be separate. Three, we do selfless service. And we see even meditation as a means of service. Remember Master's highest prayer? Lord, give me thyself that I may give thee to all. So even in the enlightenment that we're seeking, part of it is to share. And then finally, we see unity beneath the diversity of outer forms. And because we see unity, we have deep respect and deep practical kindness for everyone we meet.
Is everybody cool enough? Do we need to open windows? Or are we okay? Okay. So, yeah, we can open some windows. When we started this series, we began the very first one where we were talking about Ananda as a complete yogic lifestyle, meaning a complete way of life to bring us into union with God. Well, I'd like to look at our community life now as taking it the next step, Ananda as a renunciate lifestyle. Because really, yoga are the practices, the attitudes, techniques that bring us into union with God. And really all renunciation is a refinement. It's not different from, like, I don't feel like what I'm doing now in my life, having taken Nyaswami vows, is any different from the attitudes and practices that I embraced on the very first day I came here, just fresh out of the world. But it's more, it's a refinement and a focusing. And that's really all renunciation is. It's all we're doing, but saying, what is the most important thing? Not what am I doing part of the time, some of the time, off and on, but what is so important to me that I want to do it all the time? And Anandamayi Ma's description was beautiful. The mind wants to feast on joy. The mind want more. The more you do, you live the yogic lifestyle, the more you want to not reject things, but embrace that pattern of living. Because the more we taste it, the more we realize this is bringing me the fulfillment that I want. And so I think a good way to look at what we've been talking about, and it reflects the very first vow of the Nyaswami vows, from now on, I embrace. not I push away, I reject, I will no longer do that. I'm going to just assume kind of a pseudo personality and be a little pious person. None of that. From now on, I embrace as the only purpose in my life the search for God. And so what renunciation is in essence is embracing a greater reality of which our egos are just a little bitty part. That's all, really. Just I want to embrace the biggest concept of reality of which I am capable. And to the extent that I cling to my little ego, I can't do that. It becomes impossible. And so I would like to look at the different aspects of our community life that we've been talking about in these classes in terms of renunciation, about embracing a greater reality of which we are a little part. And the first one was just community life. You know, Swami said something very interesting many years ago. Someone asked him the question, what is Ananda's mission? And he has said different things at different times, depending on the group and his mood at the moment. When I say mood, I don't mean mood like we have moods, but, you know, just where his consciousness was in that moment. At one point he said, Ananda's mission is to have fun, which simply means to feast on joy. But another time he said, Ananda's mission is to equalize the world on the spiritual plane. And so in other words, however much the world is affirming ego and the bright lights of Hollywood and all of that, Ananda is affirming the joy of the soul. And you may, you know, if you look at the numbers, you think, well, how will we ever equalize the world on the spiritual plane? But the good news is that the worldly mind is diffuse. It is not focused. Then that's what Ananda Moy Ma was describing in such beautiful terms. When we're seeking the world, it goes out in a million different directions. But when we're seeking God, it goes only in one direction. And that one, it's like a laser beam. And, you know, the light of the sun is blazing all the time, but you shine a laser beam on something and it has great power. And so the power of a group of people, such as we living at Ananda Village and our members throughout the world, the power that we have in the focused consciousness is far greater than our numbers. And so if we are, through our renunciation, through our embracing of a greater reality than ourselves, how does this come forth? How is this expressed in different aspects of our community? Well, let's just take first community life in general. The thing that I remember when we have a son who's not now grown, but when he was little, one time he said to us, you know, the people who work at the dairy don't just think about the dairy. They think about the cows, but they think about getting the milk to the people. And the people who work at the market, they don't just think about the market. They think about all the people. And they said, and then Swami has to think about everybody. But the point is, there's a sense of integration and cooperation. And it's so much a part of the fabric of our life here that we sort of take it for granted that, of course, we'll be looking for how things can be balanced and integrated. If one operation in the community is financially stumbling or needs more people, then we take it from another area. You know, someone told us that the largest living being on this planet is an aspen grove, which covers acres and acres and acres, but it's just one tree. It's got one root system. And if the nutrients and the moisture in one area of that huge acreage that it covers, if they're richer in one area, through the root system, it shuffles it over to another part of that huge being. And Ananda is like that. There's this beautiful sense, because we're not thinking about my department is more important, or I'm more important, or my garden plot is more important, whatever it might be. We're thinking, how does it all fit together? And this is in contradiction or contradistinction to the prevalent thought in the world, which is divisiveness, competition, thinking of yourself first. And so in our very community, our community is a community of embracing a greater reality, which means renunciation. And we need to appreciate this. I mean, we take it so much for granted, but what we're doing here is an expression of a very high level of consciousness. And that's why the animals come here, the plants come here. You know, it's just there's so much vibrancy because there's a higher level of consciousness. Well, what does renunciation look like in our work, in our service? That was another area we talked about. Well, everything that we do, and you just have to, I don't see an area in the community where this isn't true. It's for the benefit of others, not for ourselves. It's embracing the greater reality. How can I serve other people at whatever cost to myself? I mean, I watch, excuse me if I embarrass you, Anashini, working at the clinic long hours so that she can save money, so that she can pay for her own trip down to South America, so that she can nurture the devotees there in the turbulent and unstable political and climate of the Latin American countries. Now, what does she get out of it? Only the joy of serving other people. And so that's in contradistinction to most people see their work as, what am I going to get out of it? How big of a car can I buy? What, you know, it's just always personal gain. And so in our service, we are living lives of renunciation. And it's important for us to understand this, because otherwise we think it's the guys in blue. They're the renunciates. But all of us are. And I think one of the best comments was some months ago, Anandi and Bharat and Jyotish and I were in town having dinner at a restaurant, and a waitress came up. She said, "Oh, you're all in blue." And Anandi, just without missing a beat, said, "We're a bowling team." And the woman said, "Oh, neat." But that's just the least of it. And sometimes new people come and they think, oh, all those people are wearing blue. But you need to understand what it means to me to wear blue is I love God more than I love myself. And if that makes you uncomfortable, I am sorry, but that is the reality of who I am. And so we need to understand we all are renunciates. We all have chosen lives of service to others beyond any personal advantage to ourselves, of integration and cooperation and trying to see the bigger picture. How does renunciation play out in our relationships? Some have chosen not to be in relationships at all. Some, their dharma, their karma dictates that they're in marriages. Some, their karma dictates that they have children. And yet the underlying attitudes of renunciation, and I see this across the board in our community, it's one of dharma and selfless service, selflessness, service to others in a selfless level, and dharma. I remember in the early days of Ananda, one of the first couples that got married, and they're still married, two very high souls. And the wife told me that shortly before they were married, the husband said to her, "I want you to understand that I want to be married to you, but I see it as a job, just like any other job, and I'll do the very best I can at it." And by that he meant dharma, duty. And that marriage has endured because they picked it up from the string in contradistinction to the way most people come together in a marriage or in a relationship, personal desire, gratification, their own likes and dislikes, fulfillment of their desires. But if we can pick it up, whether you ever wear the color blue or green or yellow or white, whatever, it's so unimportant. Really what it's about is saying, I see this not for myself, but I am fulfilling Dharma in the world. I'm doing the very best job I can, and not with any expectation of fulfillment. You know, Jyotish mentioned we were just in Los Angeles again. And I have to say, and we had a wonderful time, wonderful connections with people. But Los Angeles is just, it's almost like the dark star of Ananda. I mean, it's like everything that Ananda is, LA is not. And it's such a city of personal gratification. And one of our members there who lives in the ashram, Lori, many of you know her, she's a massage therapist and a personal coach and Pilates instructor. And she was just telling us how hard it is in Los Angeles, because she said, I used to have a practice in the Bay Area. She said, I had a waiting list. And if I couldn't make it on a certain day, people would rearrange their schedules and they would tip me and give me extra money. She said, it's so hard here. I give people my schedule and when I can come, and they'll say, Lori, I can't do yoga and Pilates on Wednesdays because I get my hair done and I can't lay on the mat. And I don't want to mess up my hairdo. And, or Lori, I can't come on Fridays. And she said, I'm not making these up. These are the things people tell her, because that's the day I get my dog's nails done. And so I just can't come. And then Lori said, well, Tuesdays I don't work. Lori, you're going to have to come on Tuesdays. It's the only day that works for me. And she said, I have never seen a group of people that it's just about me, their own needs, their own personal gratification. And Ananda is so the opposite. And that's why there is, you see a higher level of people coming together where it's based on duty, dharma, and feasting on the joy of knowing that you are coming together in God. This is sort of a funny thing that I'll share, but we have a very dear friend who is a disciple of Ananda Moy Ma, who has been very, very pivotal in our lives. She's just kind of been prophetic in many ways. And we were talking with her just a few months ago, and I was saying, I often wonder who will die first, Jyotish or me. And she kind of paused and went very quiet. And she said, no, I see you both going into the light together. And Jyotish, you know him pretty well, but he just got a little smile on his face. And he said, that means Davy will probably be driving.
In LA.
Anyway, but finally, what does renunciation look like in our search for God? And next week, that's what the whole topic will be, is Ananda, our life at Ananda in our search for God. But there's two aspects here. The first is our meditation and our sadhana, because if we understand meditation correctly, it is the ultimate form of renunciation, because we are saying, I give up my very thoughts. I am not attached to my own thinking patterns. You know, how often do we sit down and we think about, one, all we have to do that day, all these unresolved issues with other people, how what we're going to say to that person the next time we see them. And then we just have to, I don't even want my own thoughts. I want to embrace a reality greater than myself, of which I am a little part. And so in meditation, we need to see it as renunciation. And our sadhana, if we think about it, and I don't see that attitude in the community at all now, but in the early days of Ananda, there were some people who were Maha yogis, and they would be meditating literally 6-8 hours a day. And they were the most unpleasant people you would ever want to meet. They were so filled with ego and superiority and self-righteousness. And they all left. I mean, none of them are here anymore because they didn't see meditation and sadhana as renunciation. It was just another form of ego. So what if you can meditate 8 hours a day? If all it does is produce at the end of the day a lot of feeling of I'm better than everybody else, you're going backwards. And Swami talked about that. And there was another person who lived here then and who is still one of our shining lights who had a very hard time meditating. But Swami said it didn't matter because there was such purity of consciousness and humility. And that's how we need to see our sadhana, our meditation, just totally self-offering, embracing a greater reality. And if we can't do that, we'll just be, the techniques themselves will become mechanical. But if we do our meditation, the techniques, if we do kriya with a sense of merging into a greater reality, self-offering, then we start to make progress, perceptible progress with our meditation. So one thing builds on the next. And that's why, Ananda, it just, everything feeds our efforts to know God. It was so beautiful. On Saturday in Los Angeles, we had in the ashram, we had a morning retreat. And we meditated from 8 till 10, then had a little break and then a class. But we sat down to meditate, and we started with energization. And, you know, the ashram's right on the main street. And it was so, Saturday morning, so noisy. I mean, the traffic was just unrelenting. And then there was an accident and, the sirens and screeches and all that. But the most beautiful thing happened. After about a half an hour, and there were, 15, 20 of us. After about a half hour, it's like this tube of light and silence just came down and enveloped that whole room, and it was absolutely profound and silent. And afterwards, we all spoke and together, and we said, that was one of the best meditations we've ever had. And it was because the attitude of making the effort in adverse circumstances, and you could just feel Master coming in and blessing everyone there. We all felt it. Well, here we are in this environment, and the opportunities are just so profound, and for us to go very, very far. And so to see our sadhana, our meditation, as self-offering, as embracing something greater. And then finally, for me, I have to say the greatest form of renunciation and the greatest joy is simply devotion to the guru. Because what the guru is, it's a personalized form of that greater reality that links to our individuality and to our soul, to our being, and says, I know you, I love you, I will help you. Just give yourself to me. And you know, it was so beautiful. We've all heard the exchange so many times when Swamiji first came to Master, and Master asked him, will you give me your unconditional obedience? And Swamiji said, I mean, incredible. I mean, it's really awesome when you think about it. If Master says, will you give me your unconditional obedience? What would most of us say? Yes, of course, of course. But Swami was absolutely honest. And he said, what if I ever think you're wrong? And the Master's answer, the more you think about it, he could see the incredible depth of who Swami was, even in his answer, because he said, I will never ask anything of you that God doesn't tell me to ask. And so he was saying in that moment, I am your channel for God. Don't think it's me asking you. I will be your channel for God's will in your life.
And when Swami, he understood it immediately. And he didn't, he said, then I give you wholeheartedly my unconditional obedience. And so in devotion to the Guru, to embrace that greater reality and surrender to it joyfully, I trust you. I know that what we're doing here in this life is about finding that feast of joy and freedom. And so and when you think about renunciation in that way, it is such an expansive thought. Simply surrendering the ego into the love and the wisdom and the joy and the infinite presence of the Guru, who is the face of God. That's all he is. Just the bubble, the little face on the surface of God. And I want to just close by reading from Sadhu Beware, which Swami wrote before he wrote. It was sort of he was building up to the Nyaswami order as we were ready. And this is the very end, last couple paragraphs. Renunciation alone will not take anyone to God. Prayer and meditation are not enough to get there. Nor is institutional affiliation, nor even, quote, signing up, quote, with the right guru. Ultimately, no human effort will take us to God. The whole secret of the spiritual path is to get the ego and the attachments and desires that cling to it like barnacles out of the way and to receive into our souls the blessings of God. What the Guru does for us is primarily on a level of consciousness. He works from within on our thoughts and feelings. Our job above all, then, is to offer our hearts and minds up to him that he may transform us. Gradually, his egoless consciousness seeps into our ego-centered consciousness and transforms us with new understanding of our own reality. The true goal of renunciation, then, is only one: to eliminate every attachment to littleness in order that the Guru may enter and expand our awareness to infinity. So, my dear friends, it's really so simple and so beautiful. We don't have to turn ourselves inside out. We just have to open our hearts and say, I love this more than anything else I can possibly think of. God bless you.
So we'll take some questions.
I was wondering if you had any advice or suggestions for those who are not in an environment which is not really conducive to spirituality, like you're living by yourself in a big city in a little apartment and trying to get your sadhana going and trying to attain liberation. And when I left the retreat, went back to my house in Hawaii for summer, it was the most difficult thing I did, even though I went back to my house, which is a Buddhist temple in the Big Island, so it could be worse. But it was just incredibly difficult. And I was wondering if you had any tips.
Well, yeah, there's no easy answer to that, obviously. Do the best you can to get a routine, because routine will be very important. Do the best you can to surround yourself with the environment that is uplifting, music, and especially, I would say, music, but not too much connection with downward pulling energy, TV, and things of that nature. So keep your environment as sattvic as you can, but I would say the two things that are most important is to make sure that you follow your routine for sadhana. And the other is, as often as you can during the day, bring your mind back to God.
Since we've been quoting Anandamayi Ma, I'll give you a good quote from her. She said, "Better to be in the world and long for the ashram than to be in the ashram and long for the world."
Try to feel, I would say, and this is good advice for all of us, including myself, try to end our meditation by making a conscious connection with the joy within. Remember at Sunday service, I read that kind of prayer poem a couple of weeks ago of Master talking about meditating, seeing the tiny little flame, and then almost extinguishing it by loudly chanting and running after it too much. But that feel at meditation, at the end of it, that that tiny little flame is joy. And don't affirm it. Just try to feel joy in yourself. And really try to, almost like a little fire where you put little twigs on and you carefully nurture that little flame until it bursts into some bigger and bigger, eventually conflagration. But try truly to feel joy at the end of your meditation and reside in that for a while. Then try to hold on to that as you get into daily activity. And then if you get a practice of doing that, then it's more like, Master said, be like an alcoholic that takes little nips of wine during the day to keep his, in this case, his consciousness drunken, but drunk with God. And so try to, if you can feel that, actually make a true connection, then it's easier to connect with that throughout the day. It's, you won't do it during the midst of deep concentration so much, but underneath there will be a kind of a palpable joy there. And you can wake up at night and come awake and feel joyful right then and there without straining at it. So the real key is to make a personal connection with it and do that as often as possible.
Okay, well, next week... Up, Carol Gray.
Yeah. With all of us scattered here tonight, could we send a healing prayer out to the Hector?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Wonderful idea.
Thank you.
Carol suggested, for those of you who know... Christy and Leon Hecht, they have a wonderful, just a beautiful 19-year-old son that was just in a very serious car accident. He was riding his bike and a car pulled in front of him. And they live in Maine. Christy's a light bearer there and head of one of Ananda Meditation Group. And Ben's doing better. I mean, he's actually miraculous recovery, but he had quite severe brain injuries, bleeding on the brain. So we will close with that. Before we do that, just next week will be our last all community satsang, and it will be our life in Ananda and our search for God. And also wanted to remind you at the satsang we did on service that we talked about this new community practice of save an hour for God. And people are sending in what someone had the idea, actually, I think it was Anandi, had the idea of different areas sending in to the villager, and they'll print them. If you have, you know, like Varani said, she sent in something. I need help with the raking the dairy, the goat dairy, from, you know, 9 to 10 on Fridays or whatever. So people are sending in areas. But again, it's breaking down. It's the principle of integration and embracing a greater reality. So I had a wonderful save an hour last Friday where I helped Marie and Ananta, and we harvested 900 pounds of winter squash. It was just wonderful. I just enjoyed it tremendously. Okay, so any other questions, and then we'll
come back to Ben. But he did wake up. He was talking for 15 minutes, completely lucid and with it, and then They asked him, "Does your head hurt?" And he said, "Yes," and went back to sleep. But it's a very, very good sign that all the functioning seems to be there. But he can certainly use our prayers.
And a cautionary tale, he was not wearing a helmet. So, guys, wear your helmets when you're riding your bicycle. Okay, so let's close with a prayer for Ben Hecht, 19-year-old boy now living in Troy, New York, where he was going to college.
Rensselaer Polytech.
And he's a radiant boy, grew up in a household of devotees, has been to Ananda often, met Swami, went to India with his parents. So let's focus on this family. Divine Mother,
Divine Mother,
thou art omnipresent.
Thou art in Ben.
Christy and Leon.
Christy and Leon.
Manifest thy healing presence.
Manifest thy healing presence.
In their bodies.
In their bodies.
In their minds.
In their minds.
And in their souls.
And in their souls.
Peace.